We're holding in the Gel Teman, for those of you who want over here copies. We're towards the end of the second chapter, and the Rambam has been discussing that our belief or lack of belief in a prophet is irrespective of whether he is Jewish or not. There were Jewish prophets who were truthful, obviously, and there are Jewish prophets who were false prophets, and there were non-Jews who were true prophets, and there were non-Jews who were false prophets. Eov, Job, and his friends, Sofar, Bildad, Eliphaz, Elihu, we consider them prophets as the Rambam, and they were all non-Jews. So whether we accept a prophet or not is not dependent upon whether he's Jewish. But rather, the Torah teaches us what are the criteria for accepting a prophet. We know that Moshe, his prophecy was verified by us. God gave us a prophetic vision, and God showed us how he was talking to Moshe, and as such, Moshe's prophecy was verified. And God told us in the Torah that he gave us through Moshe, Lo v'shamayim, the Torah isn't in heavens. In other words, God said, I don't have any more statutes, laws, mitzvos up here in heaven. Everything I had when it comes to how you should live your life on earth, I've given you. There's nothing left up here. From now on, this is the Torah, and it's not going to change. This is how you're supposed to do it. And the Torah warns us, don't add, don't detract from the Torah. From now to the end of time, this is the way God wants it. And any prophet, regardless whether he's going to be a Kohen, a Levi, an Amaleki, any prophet, anyone that calls himself a prophet and comes in and says one of the mitzvahs of the Torah are no longer relevant, so we know he's a liar because he's trying to contradict Moshe's prophecy. And that's why we don't accept him, and he gets the death penalty. And we don't care what signs and what miracles he could do. He can make the sun set in the middle of the day. We're not interested. He's still a false prophet, so he knows how to do some kind of trick. We don't know what it is, but bottom line, that's not going to cause us to believe him. But just like if a prophet would walk in and say everyone should serve idols, we wouldn't accept it, and we wouldn't care what signs he'd make. And that's what our parsha says. Even if the false prophet gives you a sign and it happens, he says, tomorrow morning, 5 million babies will rain down from heaven. You wake up in the morning, you see babies coming down from heaven with parachutes. You say, okay, that's unnatural. He says, tomorrow all the trees will start uprooting themselves. You'll see, you're going to walk outside and tree after tree is going to start falling down. No wind, no nothing. You walk outside, you see trees starting to fall like dominoes. You say, wait a second, that's amazing. He must be a prophet. That's a miracle. So God says, yeah, he might be able to do miracles. God tells us in the Torah, a false prophet may be able to do miracles. He might be able to give you signs. And that shouldn't cause you to listen to that prophet. Don't fear the prophet, our parsha tells us. That person is a false prophet and he deserves the death penalty. And this is one of the tests that I will send you, God says. That I will send for, not I will send, but I will make the possibility for false prophets to arise. And you have to be able to withstand that test. And that's part of what God told Moshe Rabbeinu. He said, you know why I'm making all of the Jewish people hear prophecy? Why all of them are seeing me appear at Sinai and tell them the Ten Commandments? God is coming now and revealing himself to you so that you could stand up to tests in the future. Once you've seen this and you know that the Torah is 100% true, so from now on, you know that anyone that tries to contradict it is not. V'chein amar lanu Moshe alav shalom, and so too Moshe told us. We're holding page Kuf Mem Ches Kemach in Igeret Teman of Rambam Na'am. If you want to pass me that version, I'll try to find it there. Okay. Good job. What? With the chair, I can't reach it either.
Oh, thank you.
In Rav Shilat's edition, it's page Kuf Lamed Ches, the one line up, second to last line. V'chein amar lanu Moshe Rabbeinu alav shalom. So too Moshe Rabbeinu told us שהתורה הזאת עומדת לעולם, that the Torah is eternal. לפיכך, therefore, כל נביא שיאמר, any prophet that says שהיא לזמן, that the Torah is finite and not infinite, יש לנו לדעת משפט נבואתו. We have to know that the way we deal with that kind of prophet is שהוא נביא שקר, he's a false prophet. שהרי בא להכחיש משה רבינו, he's trying to contradict Moshe. לפיכך, therefore, once a prophet walks in and says, you know what? The Torah's mitzvahs were relevant, but now some of them are irrelevant. So we say, "Lo nevakesh mimenu ot mufet." Once he says that, we don't ask him for a sign or a miracle. V'imasan, even if he'd offer one, lo nashgiach bo. We don't pay any attention to him. Shenachshov shu mufet basototo. We don't consider it a miracle when he does it. Lefi shu manutenu v'moshe. For our belief is in it, Moshe, and that belief lo aita mitzad mufet was not because of a miracle, because כדי שנתחייב מצד זה להקיש בין מופת הנביא הזה למופת משה רבינו. If it were, if our belief in Moshe stemmed from a miracle, then we'd have to start comparing. We'd say, okay, Moshe Rabbeinu, what did he do? He turned the Nile to blood. So this guy will walk in and he'll turn the Atlantic to blood. Doesn't interest us. He's still a false prophet because our belief in Moshe does not stem from the miracles that Moshe did. אבל האמנו בו לפי ששמענו הדבר כמו ששמע הוא. We believed Moshe, because we heard the word of God just as he himself heard it. We stood at Sinai and God revealed himself to all of us. And as such, we believed in Moshe, a true belief that is eternal. As the verse says, God told him, I will come and I will reveal myself to you at Sinai. And one of the things that will happen as a result of my revelation is that they will believe in you forever. V'anachnu b'inyan zeh Moshe Rabbeinu, and we together with Moshe with regard to this, k'mo shnei edim she'idu sh'ru shum davar. We're like two prophets that testify that we saw something. If me and David sat here and we saw Abraham walk in this morning, so 5,000 people could come and say, he didn't walk in this morning. We'll turn the Atlantic to blood. We're going to make a miracle. We'll prove it. Look, we're going to say, okay, you could do every miracle you want, but we saw it. We were there. We know what happened. By the same token, when it comes to our belief in the Torah, it's not that we're saying, oh, there was a miracle, so we know. We're saying we all merited to attain the level of prophecy. That's what the Torah is saying. And as such, when someone tries to tell you something you yourself witnessed is not there, so you say, wait a second, I was there. I know it's so. So too, when it comes to the Torah and the Torah's being eternal and every mitzvah being eternal, so that we know. And we don't know it by merit of a miracle, but we know it by merit of the fact that we ourselves witnessed God's prophecy. When two witnesses testify, each one knows what he's saying is true, and he knows what his counterpart is saying is true. And they don't feel a necessity to prove what they're saying is true to other people. They know it's true. By the same token, the Rambam is trying to tell the people of Yemen, even though these Muslims are trying to get you to convert, and they're trying to make you stand up and refute all their arguments, I've already shown you that their arguments don't hold water. But that shouldn't bother you, whether their arguments do hold water, don't hold water. We know what we're saying is true. When you know what you're saying is right, you don't have to stand up and try to convince the world. Rabbi Wein once said a scary thought. He said, a nation that's confident about their future, that they will never again have a Holocaust, doesn't have to proclaim never again. V'chena davar banu. And so too, says the Rambam, with regard to us, anachnu adat Yisrael, we, the Jewish people, yadanu amitut Moshe Rabbeinu, we know the truthfulness of Moshe, our teacher, lefishrinu b'ma'amad har Sinai b'shat ha'dibur, for we ourselves witnessed it at the stands, when we stood at Sinai, when God spoke to him. Lo mipnei ha'mufet, not as a result of a sign, aval asa kol ma she'asa ma'ani ha'muftim, all the signs that Moshe did do were lefi ha'tzorech, because they were necessary. Kmo she'itvei yom mipsukei ha'Torah, as the Torah clarifies. And because this very important point, people tend to forget, and people don't rely on this. We have to remember this is an important point, that we don't believe miracles or signs like we believe Moshe. And we don't equate someone who could do miracles with our belief in the Torah. And as such, King Solomon said, as representing the nation in the Song of Songs, he said, what do you see among the Jewish people who are whole in their belief? Like their rejoicing of the two camps. Amar, what King Solomon was telling the nations, you're trying to entice me to leave my faith and join yours. If you could replicate the stance of Sinai, that 2 million people stood and saw prophecy that God revealed himself, then I'm willing to accept what you're saying. But don't try to get me to leave my faith when you're not doing anything that comes close to the beginning of my faith, which was the stance at Sinai, with that 2 million people witnessed prophecy. Yeah?
Notice that the Lashon here is different to what you're reading.
Yeah, it's slightly different.
Is there not one uniform version of the Hebrew?
There is an Arabic. The Rambam wrote in Arabic. So I'm reading one translation, you're reading another translation. Lefichach, therefore, im yamod navi miYisrael umshaumot, if a prophet stands from Israel or from any other nation, v'yikav ne'adam l'dato shel Moshe Rabbeinu, and he calls people and says, you should follow the religion of Moshe, our teacher. V'lo yisif v'lo yigra, he doesn't add, he doesn't detract. Kmo Yeshayahu, just as Isaiah did, v'yomiyahu, and Jeremiah, v'zulatam, and the other prophets. If what he says is in line with the Torah, he says, keep the Torah. So then, he's saying he's a prophet. So nishan mimenu mufet, we ask him, give us a sign. Im yiten mufet, if he could give us a sign, na'amin bo, then we'll believe him. V'yetzeinu b'malot anvim, and then we give him the stature of the prophets. V'im yichsal v'yipol shum devar mikol dvarav yarei. But if he says something in prophecy, and it doesn't happen 100%, he gets a death penalty. Let's say he says, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., it's going to start raining. And at 10:30 it starts raining, he gets a death penalty. Because one of the signs of a true prophet is that what he says is exactly true. In comparison with all the soothsayers and other fortune tellers who sometimes can see the future, but they cannot see accurately. The Gemara tells us that the people who look in the stars, the astrologers in their time, didn't know how to foretell the future. When Rabbi Akiva's daughter was born, the astrologer told him, your daughter's going to die the day of her wedding. On the day of her wedding, a poor man came to the wedding hall and she took her plate and she gave him to eat. And when she went into the room, as she was fixing her hair, she took the needle out of her hair and stuck it in a crack between the wall and started fixing her hair. When she finished and she wanted to put the needle, the pin back into her hair, she pulled out the needle from the wall and there was a venomous snake at the end of the needle, dead. She had killed the snake as she took it out of the as she had placed it in the wall. So she called her father over and her father said, you must have done a mitzvah today, because that was the snake the astrologer saw. You were supposed to die today. What mitzvah did you do today? Think for a second. And she thought back and she remembered, yeah, I gave my plate, I gave a portion to a poor man. That's why we have the custom, I think that's why we have the custom today, that a chasan and kala on the day of their chuppah are busy with giving food to poor people. Many organizations will call you and ask you to, if you post your invitation in a yeshiva, so organizations know this custom and they go around to yeshivas and they see invitations and they start calling people and say, well, there's this custom, why don't you fund our organization? But it's a good idea, so long as you know the organization isn't a con artist. There are con artists who do it too.
Is there any rules with etiquette halakhically of when you can and can't ask tzedakah? I was asking, because I was at a wedding last night and I couldn't believe it. We're saying the kavanah, and there's a guy coming around collecting tzedakah, and I'm like, this is a wedding. Like, what? Is there just no concept of what's appropriate or what?
It goes two ways. On the one hand, in Rabbi Kivud's daughter's wedding, a poor man came. He wanted to eat. She gave him to eat. And as such, he saved her life.
He's just collecting. He's got like over 1,000 shekels in his hand. He's asking.
It's difficult. This is a difficult thing to call. Because on the one hand, you're right. This isn't the time where you want to deal with it. On the other hand, his life, theoretically, assuming he's truthful, his life is miserable. And here, people might be more apt to give. What some people do is they take portions. We had this in Muncie, where Tomchei Shabbos would have. You could, when you're making a wedding, you could order another certain amount of portions, which you give to poor families. And sometimes you'd invite them to the wedding, so the couple would get to go on a date, and they'd come to a wedding, and like any other guest, then no one knows that they're a poor family. And what other people do is they send money at their wedding. It used to be a custom that when a person would marry off his child, he'd marry off an orphan on the, at the same time. The halacha discusses, how do you do two weddings at once? Why does the halacha discuss that? Because the ancient custom was that people who could afford it, when they'd marry off their child, they would also marry off an orphan that can't afford it. So it's a little difficult to know how to call the shot.
These guys that just come around collecting.
I think what's bothering us is that very often we feel like they're not real. If we know that this person really doesn't have bread to put on the table, then I'm not sure it would bother us that he's collecting because he needs the money. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know how to...
The funny thing is, 10 minutes earlier, I was thinking, wow, I want, how long can you go through a day in Yerushalayim without having someone ask you for tzedakah? And 10 minutes later, this guy...
I think that on the one hand, when people ask us for tzedakah, we should give something when we can. On the other hand, our big money we should give to places where we know where it's going. It's important that we invest to verify.
Well, if someone asks you on the street, the obligation is not there. Whereas if somebody comes to your door and knocks, there's a great obligation.
I don't think there's an obligation either way. You're not obligated to give a person who you don't know who he is. The Gemara says, we bless the swindlers. Thanks to the swindlers, we're not obligated to give tzedakah because you never know who's legitimate and who isn't legitimate. But that doesn't absolve our obligation to give tzedakah. We can give through an organization. We can verify who really needs and give them. We have an obligation to give tzedakah, but we are not obligated when someone knocks at our door and asks us, unless they ask for food. For food, if someone says, I'm hungry, you have to give them. You don't have to give them a three-course meal. You can give them bread and water. But if a person says he's hungry, you have to give him food. Food is the only thing. That's why when very often people ask me for food, I say, fine, come. People sometimes stop me on the street and say, I'm hungry, I haven't eaten in 3 days. So I say, fine, come. I give them my lunch. I'll give you right now a sandwich, here. They never want that. They always want money. I've never had someone take me up on that. Never. All the people who have come to me and said, I'm hungry, and I've offered them, sometimes they say, yeah, I want you to take me out to this restaurant, to that restaurant. I don't go to a restaurant. I'm not going to take you out to a restaurant. If you want, I'll buy you bread, I'll buy you milk, I'll buy you basic necessities. Fine. I'm not going to spend that kind of money. And I've never had someone take me up on it. But that doesn't absolve our obligation. No, we always have to worry, maybe a person will be hungry. I don't know. It's like the question when you go to the Kotel, people stop you in your davening. But you should know there's a famous street here named Strauss. There were two brothers who owned many clothing stores named Strauss, and they both were very, very wealthy. And they wanted to go on a cruise together, and this cruise went throughout Europe, and it stopped off at Palestine. So they got off the cruise, and before I continue the story, I want to tell you how I know this story. I want to tell you that sometimes it's worthwhile to have a little bit of chutzpah. Whenever I meet my rabbis, I ask them for a Dvar Torah. So that's a little bit of chutzpah. Why am I asking them for a Dvar Torah? But I always walk away wealthier than I walked into the conversation. So I was talking to Rabbi Feinstein, and I asked him for a Dvar Torah. So he told me, Dvar Torah, I'm not going to tell you now, but I'll tell you the following story. And he told me this story, that the two brothers, Strauss, one was Nathan Strauss, and I don't know the other one's name. They both came on this cruise ship that was a very, very, very fancy ship. Only multimillionaires could afford to go on the ship. And they were traveling throughout, and this ship stopped at Palestine. And they went, and they toured a little bit, and they hit the Kotel. And in those days, too, there were poor people at the Kotel. But I guess then they had more convincing stories, and their stories were probably true. People were dying of hunger in Israel. And many families lost children to hunger here in Israel. So the the brothers came and people bombarded them, asking them, look, I have this problem, I have that problem, help me with this, help me with that. And they started giving a little here, a little there, a little more, a little more, a little more. And then one brother said to the other, he said, you know, it's time to get back to the ship. The ship's pulling out of port. So Nathan Strauss said, yeah, but there are people here who are in such dire need. I'll catch it at the next port. I'll take a private ship. I'll catch up. You go ahead. I'm staying to see how I could help you. And Nathan Strauss stayed and funded a lot of things. That ship was the Titanic, and his brother sank on it. His brother died, and he lived. He stayed here doing tzedakah. He stayed, because he stayed at the Kotel, he wasn't on the Titanic. Because he stayed helping people out, and that's why they named the street.
Of, the 20th century?
Yeah, the story goes back then. And that's why we have a street named after him here in Yerushalayim, because he funded a lot of things in Israel. You never know. You never know who's helping whom. And even at the Kotel, so you have to, again. It's one thing to give people, it's another thing to give your main tzedakah that you have to check that you're giving to a good place. Yeah. I don't know. There's a man who had a heart attack. He has 12 kids. He can't support the family. You give him a shekel. The next guy gives him a shekel.
If you encourage the, I support all this stuff, organization thing, but if you encourage the tendency, I don't know.
I'm not sure you're encouraging dependency. There's a situation where I'll give you an example. We had in the community last year a woman who was very ill. So they had 5 kids at home, and the husband had to take care of the 5 kids, the home, and his wife. And the medical insurance in the country didn't cover about 15,000 shekel a month of medication that she needed. What's he supposed to do? That's medication. I'm not talking about education of his kids. But where's he going to cover from? Rent. And he can say, I got to go to work, I got to fund the family. And who's going to take care of his wife? She was an orphan, she didn't have any parents. And his parents were Olim Hadashim. True story, happened here in the neighborhood. We tried to arrange funds for the family. What are you going to say? You're encouraging dependency by helping him out?
No.
So I'm just saying, we have to know that with the Hasidim that come every day collecting are supposed to be collecting for other people. I know I once met a poor person, and I asked him, he started telling me his story, and I asked him, okay, so how do people help you out? So he told me, this and this chassid that collects in the following shuls, one of them I dabbled in, and he happened to come to me every day, he's collecting and he helps me out too. So I thought, wow, that's very nice. You know, I always thought maybe they're collecting for a fund, or I don't know what. And it turns out that no, some of these people, can't say all of them, even though they're collecting every day, and you could see them for 15 years, but they're collecting for situations where people are in dire need. There's another family in Mea Sharm, which I met 7 years ago. They had a child born with spina bifida, that part of the spine is revealed. And that child needs a lot of help, a lot of therapy, a lot of things, and hopefully one day she'll be able to do a lot of things. So what are parents to do? The system in Israel today, and even the system in the United States, doesn't cover everything you need. And when, God forbid, a medical situation arises, I'm not talking about other situations, but let's take a medical situation. Where's the person supposed to cover it from? So you could say everyone should have insurance that covers what the insurance doesn't cover. Every organization is swamped. I 2 months ago I met the head of a soup kitchen here in Yerushalayim. So I asked him, I said, you know, I never heard of you, why don't you advertise? So he told me, because every time I've advertised, I've had another 50 to 100 clients, and I didn't get the donations to offset the clients. So I can't do that. I can't handle the influx of people who need food. So there are people who really need food here in Jerusalem. I mean, here in Israel. I'm not talking about the United States or other places where I'm not saying people don't need. I'm just saying I don't know what's going on elsewhere.
I understand the business piece. when you're giving them, if you were to say, okay, I'll set aside this amount of money and I'll give this to the organization that will directly give it to you, and you tell them all that information, that would be actually helping them more as opposed to...
For sure. A lot of times when a person comes and tries to tell me a whole story, so after I hear the whole story, and that's one of the halachas in tzedakah, that even if you can't help a person financially, you're supposed to help him spiritually, emotionally, by listening to the story and commiserating with him. So very often I'll say, okay, let's get you in touch with an organization like Pa'amunim, which helps people put their financial situation in order. But you should also know, we had a student here in the Machon a half a year ago, who his wife got ill and she couldn't go to work. She just couldn't walk. She couldn't leave bed. And he lost his job at the same time. And suddenly they couldn't pay the electric bill and they couldn't pay the rent. And he had 4 or 5 children. He had a bunch of children. I mean, this goes back a year ago. This was the beginning of last year. So we gave him a loan. It was like 7,000 or 10,000 shekel because he hadn't paid rent in 3 months. I told him, you're going to get evicted. How long is your landlord going to put up with this? You have kids. You don't want to find yourself out in the street tomorrow. So until you get a job, and slowly but surely, in the last half year, he's been paying back that loan. So that's what? Right. So what we did was, we did it through Gmach, through an organization. That's what we did. We said, instead of giving you the money, here's the organization, and you'll work out with them. So it is often better to work a person to an organization, but you can't take every person that comes to you on the street and put them to an organization. Many people that come to my door, I tell them, if you want a job, I'll try to help you get a job. And I do. If you're collecting because you didn't have a job, okay, so I'll try and help you. And there are a lot of people, you know, I forward, even here in the Machon, I forward you guys job information, people who want cleaning jobs and stuff. That's true, but at the end of the day, there are still going to be those people, like this father whose wife and children, he can't go to work. He needs the public to help him, and that's part of the social contract that we each help one another in times of need. What? Okay, so it's hard to know when a person's coming collecting. It's hard to know, but that's why I wouldn't give him a lot. And when we don't give him, we acquire the midat ha'chzariyut. When we give him, so even if he didn't deserve, I'm a better person after I gave him a shekel. When I don't give him, I'm a less compassionate person, I'm a less caring person by not having given him. So it's better that I give him just so that I remain a good person, and that's why it's better to give him a small amount.
What about like people come here at the yeshiva every single day? Why isn't the yeshiva saying, let's help you, let's set up an organization so that you can, that it means better that they have, like, people come to the yeshiva every single day.
So again, maybe they are an organization, like these Hasidim who come where I daven, which I didn't know, but I found out later that they were. I'm just saying, I don't know who's coming here.
They're collecting for the organization?
Yeah. Where I down, yeah.
And if, for those who perhaps are not?
Some people I wouldn't give, right? And there's a person who comes to Merkaz Harav for 11 years now. And I see him. He's going all around. I see him in Meshem. I see him all over. He spends his day collecting. I don't give him. He's healthy. There's another guy who tells all kinds of stories about his wife needing all kinds of shots. He lives in a villa on Rav Chaim Vital. I don't get him.
Whether you know that he lives in a villa.
I saw him taking out the garbage there once. I asked him for his address. He was living there. It was very obvious he was living there. There was a guy I know who was adopted. And after 20 some odd years, he wanted to know who his real mother was. So he went to the adoption agency and he checked. And it turns out she's one of these people that sits around the Tachna Merkazit and collects money. So he catches up to her and he finds her living in this beautiful apartment with everything on the outside. When she goes collecting, she puts on junky clothing. But she has a beautiful apartment. And he asked her what's going on. So she said, some people make their money by selling you garbagey clothing and they tell you it's a good brand. And other people make their money by it the way I do. So I give people the ability to have the mitzvah of giving tzedakah. Pretty crooked way of looking at things. And not only that, this is a woman who took a child and put him up for adoption. She had good money, but she put him up for adoption because she didn't feel like having that expense. So there's something wrong with her. it's easy to remember the story every time someone comes and asks you for tzedakah and think, well, maybe they're one of those. She's a person who gives a child up for adoption and is living in the lap of luxury. And many people will do that. But we have to remember that most people really do need, if they need for this cause or that cause. And if we can't help them to verify what they need for, if we don't have the time to sit down with every person that comes to us, you'll go to the kotel, 100 people will ask you for tzedakah, literally. On certain days you could be asked by 100 people. Especially if you give $10 to one, then for sure you'll be asked by another 99. So on the one hand, we don't have the time to be able to go through each one. On the other hand, it's not so simple that we can avoid it. The Chatam Sofer, I don't remember, one of the rabbis of Vilna, when he became rabbi of Vilna, I don't remember who it was, so he sat down after a short time and wrote his rabbi a letter. He said, back in my hometown, when I leave shul, I tell everyone good morning. Over here, I have 150 congregants. If I tell everyone good morning, I'm never going to make it home. Back in my hometown, if a poor person asked me for tzedakah, as I left shul, I gave him. Here, when I leave shul, there are 150 paupers standing outside the door. How can I pass one and not give him? And how could I not? And how could I give each one?
If he lived in Hungary, isn't
it? It wasn't the Chatam Sofer. I don't remember who it was. And I don't remember. It was one of the rabbis of Vilna 150, 200 years ago. I don't remember who it was. So he didn't take it for granted that, well, just because I can't verify each one's story, that absolves my obligation from helping each one. It's a complicated question. So we have to try and maintain our sensitivity. And that's a little difficult when we're being bombarded with requests for money.
So the thing is to go to an organization, right? To not give anything.
So no.
It's like you never can be sure about the fact, and probably you.
But not every organization is necessarily good.
So but in an organization,
you can figure out how easily if it's good or not.
That's like, too simple.
I don't know. You can ask rabbis here.
You're supposed to diversify your tzedakah, and you're also supposed to be a kind person. And every time you say no to someone who asks you for tzedakah, then you lose a little bit of the kindness that might have been in you. And that's why it's good to give something. A half a shekel, each person according to his ability. It's good to give something, hopefully it's real tzedakah, and at least you'll be a better person afterwards. And the main tzedakah to give through an organization that you know, or an organization or a rabbi. One of the poorest rabbis in Jerusalem used to walk with tens of thousands of shekels in his pocket every day. Because he was wheeling and dealing in tzedakah. So his pockets were always filled with money and he didn't own a penny. He was a pauper in his house. He barely had more than a chair, a bed, and almost nothing. But all the money was tzedakah. So rabbis also, that's one thing that many rabbis do. They get tzedakah and they know who needs. It's their job to know. So you could do it that way. There you gain that you don't lose. In an organization, you lose because some of it is used to fund the organization, but that's also important. You need the organization. So it's a catch-22, and everything's important. This is important, and that's important. They're all important. But
I give it to Machon Meir.
Machon Meir is a learning institution. That's good for one thing, but it's also good to give people who are hungry. There are people out there who are hungry. So both are good. It's good to give tzedakah to Machon Meir, but it's also good to give to a place where people are hungry.
People come inside. I saw like more than two of them outside buying cigarettes. I never give this person again because why should I give a person who's buying cigarettes?
So that's a tough call. I used to think that way too. One of the families we once arranged assistance for, I saw that they bought all their food in the makolet. So they bought it in the little grocery store. So I said, wait a second. They're paying 35% more for everything they're purchasing. Why don't they go and buy it in a store like Aleph, Zolpo, Barco? In these stores, they'd save literally 30%. And if they're wasting their money, how could we give them tzedakah money? So I had the difficult situation where I was made responsible for the money. I wasn't collecting it. I wasn't interested in this. But everyone else said, you take care of it. So I went to the people who gave me the responsibility and I said, hey, it's very nice you're telling me to take care of it, but I want you to take care of this. How could it be that the family is wasting the money and buying things at a high price? So the first answer I got, which taught me something, was that this is typical for a family in a needy situation. When a person feels like, I don't have the money to to put a slice of bread on the table. And suddenly I get 100 shekel in my hand. So the feeling is that, well, I don't know where life's holding as it is. It's not like one shekel more, one shekel less will make a difference. The Gemara says, the reason the poor remain poor is because they eat amenities. The reason the rich remain rich is because they take off from their money and they'll save it in order to buy a bigger house, in order to have better investments. The poor feel like they'll never make it out of being poor. So they figure, what's the difference if I spend another shekel here, another shekel there? The rich realize, hey, wait a second, if I save a few shekels here and a few shekels there, it's all going to add up and eventually I'll have more money to invest and I'll make more money. Part of the psychological situation a poor person is in is that he feels like he'll never get out of it. And as such, he's more apt to waste whatever money he has than to save because he doesn't feel like there's a point in saving. And this is part of what the organizations, a good organization like Pamonim, works with the poor to train them not to work that way. And we also worked with this family. This family, we got them to work in a more frugal way. But we have to realize that just because a person's wasting the money is not indicative of his situation. Quite the contrary, sometimes that in itself is an indication of the difficult situation he's in. But now we've gone way off on a tangent, and let's go back and finish this chapter in Igeret Teiman. The Rambam said, the fact that we believe a prophet when he gives us a sign, even though it could be that he's lying, maybe he figured out a way of tricking us, the reason is because God commanded us through Moshe in the Torah. When two witnesses walk in and testify that something happened, you must rule based upon their testimony. You believe them, you assume they are truthful witnesses, you test them, you check them, but at the end of the day you believe them. And even though they might be lying, by the same token God said, if a prophet walks in and gives a sign, and everything seems to be legitimate, so then go by what he's saying. He tells you, go out to war tomorrow. Listen to him, he didn't tell you to transgress the Torah. If he's given a sign, if he's done the prerequisites for accepting him as a prophet, so then accept him as a prophet just as you would accept two witnesses, even though they might be lying. And even though, afterwards when you find out he's lying, you say, wait a second, why did I listen to him? So then answer yourself, no, I listened to him because that's what the Torah said I should do. The Torah said, if a person walks in and says I'm a prophet, test him, ask him for a sign. If he's given the sign, believe him, even though he might be a false prophet. This is the way the Torah told us to approach prophets. So long as he hasn't contradicted the Torah. And the Rambam ends the chapter, and in truth, we've really clarified this subject in the beginning of our great work, the explanation of the Mishnah. In the Rambam's introduction to his explanation on the Mishnah, he explains the rules of when we do not accept the prophet. And from there you will be able to learn these important things which are the foundations of the Torah and of Jewish faith. What you have to know, that just as there are no additions or detractions from the Torah, by the same token, we do not add or detract from the understanding that we have on tradition. The way we understand the Torah, that tefillin are supposed to look like this, that's the understanding that's going to remain. It's not going to change. And that is with respect to the understanding that we have on tradition, one from another, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And this is what we call the oral law. So what we saw today was that the Rambam said our belief in a prophet is not contingent on whether he's Jewish or not. It's contingent on whether he fulfills the prerequisites for being accepted as a prophet. And that is that he doesn't contradict the Torah or tell us to detract from the Torah. And once he fulfills those obligations and whatever other obligations there are in order for him to be a prophet, then we ask him for a sign. Otherwise, we don't care if he gives us a sign. And the reason why we won't accept the prophet contradicting the Torah is because with respect to the Torah, it's as though we saw it with our own two eyes because we all saw prophecy. And the Rambam ended off the chapter and said that by the same token that a prophet cannot detract or add to the Torah, so too he cannot detract or add when it comes to the tradition we have that goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu, Torah Shabbat Teh. This last point needs definition because we know that as a rabbi, the rabbis did sometimes disagree with previous generations. So, in short, what the Rambam writes in the introduction to the Mishnah is that there's a difference between whether a prophet walks in and says something using the laws of logic and whether he says it as a prophet. Meaning, if a prophet were to walk in here and prove to us from the Torah that tefillin should look differently, then there exists a possibility we'd accept what he's saying, because he's not saying it as a prophet, he's saying it as a rabbi. But if that same prophet would walk in and say, I'm telling you on prophecy, that even though your tradition is that tefillin have to look this way, the Torah meant differently, he gets a death penalty. The difference being, did he say it and say, believe me because I'm a prophet, or did he say it and say, come, I'll prove it to you from the Torah, I'll say it as a rabbi, not as a prophet. And that's what the Rambam writes in his introduction to Mishnah. And that's what I assume he means over here, that the prophet cannot change our tradition. He means he cannot change it as a prophet. But just like in the first temple, they used to do Nisa Hamayim, libation in the temple, one way. And then in the second temple, they overruled it. They said, we do it a different way. How could they do that? And they could do that because they did it by the force of their strength as rabbis, by using the laws of derivation from the Torah. They didn't use it by the strength of prophecy. Any questions? Okay. Bokatov.